asked Surbiton, "that you will be comfortable at Drosdelnok?" Rex smiled. "Are you asking me if I have the nerve?"
"Speaking bluntly, yes, I suppose I am."
"I don't know. Have you?" The ghost of a smile hovered on the pale, fleshless face as the albino considered the question. His slender fingers tapped gently at the desktop.
"The question is a good one. Yes, I have the nerve. My fears are unconnected with death."
"You have read my mind," said Rek. "You tell me if I have the nerve. I mean it. I don't know if I can stand a drawn-out siege. It is said that men fail under such pressure."
"I cannot tell you," Surbiton answered, "if you will hold or fail. You are capable of both. I cannot analyze all the permutations of a siege. Ask yourself this. What if Virai fell? Would you stay on?"
"No," said Rek instantly. "I would saddle a fast horse and be gone. I don't care about Drosdelnok or the Drenai Empire."
"The Drenai are finished," said Surbiton. "Their star has fallen."
"Then you think the Dross will fall?"
"Ultimately it must. But I cannot see that far into the future as yet. The way of the mist is strange. Often it will show events still to come, but more often it will show events never to be. It is a perilous path, which only the true mystic walks with certainty."
"The way of the mist?" asked Rek.
"I am sorry, why should you know? It is a road on another plane, a fourth dimension, a journey of the spirit, like a dream. Only you direct the dream and see what you desire to see. It is a concept hard to verbalize to a non-speaker."
"Are you saying your soul can travel outside the body?" asked Rek.
"Oh yes, that is the easy part. We saw you in Graven Forest, outside the cabin. We helped you then by influencing the Axeman, Grasin."
"You made him kill Reynard?"
"No, our powers are not that great. We merely pushed him in a direction he was considering already."
"I am not sure I am entirely comfortable knowing you have that sort of power," said Rek, avoiding the albino's green eyes. Surbiton laughed, his eyes sparkling, his pale face mirroring his joy.
"Friend Rek, I am a man of my word. I promised never to use my gift to read your mind, and I shall not. Nor will any of the 30. Do you think we would be priests forsaking the world if we wished harm to others? I am the son of an earl, but if I wished I could be a king, an emperor mightier than Ulrich. Do not feel threatened. We must be at ease one with the other. More, we must be friends."
"Why?" asked Rek.
"Because we are about to share a moment which comes only once in a lifetime," said Surbiton. "We are going to die."
"Speak for yourself," said Rek. "I do not see that going to Drosdelnok is just another way of committing suicide. It's a battle, that's all. No more nor less than that. A wall can be defended. A smaller force can hold a larger. History is full of examples. Skeln Pass, for example."
"True," said Surbiton. "But they are remembered because they are exceptions. Let us deal in facts. The Dross is defended by a force less than a third of full complement. Morale is low, fear is rife. Ulrich has a force in excess of 500,000 warriors, all willing, lusting even, to die for him in battle. I am a weapon master and a student of war. Drosdelnok will fall. Clear your mind of any other conclusion."
"Then why come with us? What will you gain from it?"
"We die," said Surbiton, "and then live. But I shall say no more of that at this time. I do not wish to depress you, Rek. If it would serve a purpose, I would fill you with hope. but my whole battle strategy will be built around delaying the inevitable. Only then can I function and serve your cause." "I hope you will keep that opinion to yourself," said Rek. "Virai believes we can hold. I know enough of warfare and morale to tell you plainly that if your theory were to spread among the men, there would be wholesale desertions. We would lose on the first day."
"I am not a fool, Rek. I say this to you because it needs to be said. I shall be your advisor at Delnok, and you will need me to speak the truth. I shall have no real dealings with the soldiers, neither will the 30. Men will avoid us anyway, once they know what we are."
"Perhaps. Why do you say you will be my advisor? El Delnar commands. I shall not even be an officer there."
"Let us say," said Serbitar, "that I will be the advisor to your cause. Time will explain all far better than I. Have I depressed you?"
"Not at all. You have told me everything is hopeless, that we are all dead men, and the Draenei are finished. Depressed? Not at all." Serbitar laughed and clapped his hands. "I like you, Rek," he said. "I think you will hold firm."
"I will hold firm, all right," said Rek, smiling, "because I will know that at the last wall I will have two horses waiting ready saddled. By the way, do you not have anything stronger than water to drink?"
"Sadly, no," answered Serbitar. "Alcohol inhibits our strength. If you need spirits, however, there is a village nearby, and I can have someone ride out for you to purchase some."
"You don't drink? There are no women? You eat no meat? What do you do for recreation?"
"We study," said Serbitar, "and we train, and we plant flowers and raise horses. Our time is well occupied, I can assure you."
"No wonder you want to go away and die somewhere," said Rek, with feeling.
Virai sat with Vintar in a small, sparsely furnished study, awash with manuscripts and leather-bound tomes. There was a small desk littered with broken quills and scrawled parchment. She held back a smile as the older man fumbled with his breastplate strap. He could not have looked less a warrior.
"Can I help you?" she asked, standing up and leaning over the desk.
"Thank you, my dear," he said. "It weighs heavily."
He balanced the armour against the desk and poured himself some water, offering the jug to Virai, who shook her head.
"I'm sorry the room is such a mess, but I have been hurrying to finish my diary. So much to say, so little time."
"Bring it with you," she said.
"I think not. Too many other problems to wrestle with once we are underway."
"You have changed since I saw you last, Virai."
2 years is a long time, Abbot," she said carefully.
"I think it is the young man with you," he said, smiling. "He has a great influence."
"Nonsense. I am the same.
Your walk is more assured. You are less clumsy than I remember. He has given you something, I think."
"Never mind that. What about the dross?" she snapped, blushing.
"I am sorry, my dear. I did not wish to embarrass you."
"You have not embarrassed me," she lied. "Now, about Dross Delnok, how can you help us?"
"As I told your father 2 years ago, our help will be in organization and planning. We will know the enemy's plans. We can aid you in thwarting them. Tactically, we can organize the defenses, and militarily, we can fight like 100. But our price is high."
"My father has deposited 10,000 gold rack in Ventria," she said, "with the merchant Asbidair."
"Good. Then that is settled. We ride in the morning."
"May I ask you something?" said Virai.
He opened his hands and waited.
"Why do you need the money?"
"For the next temple of the 30. Each temple is financed by the death of the last."
"Oh, what happens if you don't die? I mean, supposing we win?"
His eyes searched her face for a matter of moments.
"Then we return the money," he said.
"I see," she said. You are unconvinced?
It doesn't matter. What do you think of Rec?
In what way? Asked Winter.
Let us not play games, Father Abbot. I know you can read minds. I want to know what you think of Rec.
The question is not precise enough. No, let me finish, he said, watching her anger rise. Do you mean as a man, as a warrior, or as a prospective husband for the daughter of an earl?
All three, if you like. I don't know. Just tell me.
Very well. Do you believe in destiny?
Yes, she said, remembering the same question she had asked of Reg. Yes, I do.
Then believe this. You were destined to meet. You are the perfect match. You boost his strengths and counter his weaknesses. What he does for you, you know already. As a man, he is not unique, nor even very special. He has no great talents, is not a poet, a writer, or a philosopher. As a warrior, well, he has a sporadic courage that hides great fears. But he is a man in love, and that will increase his strength and his power to combat his fears. As a husband, in days of peace and plenty, I feel he would be wayward. But for now, he loves you and is prepared to die for you. You can ask no more of a man than that.
Why did I meet him now, of all times? She asked, tears stinging her eyes. I don't want him to die. I would kill myself, I think.
No, my dear, I don't think you would, though I agree that you would feel like doing so.
Why now?
Why not? Live or die, a man and a woman need love. There is a need in the race. We need to share, to belong. Perhaps you will die before the year is out. But remember this. To have may be taken from you. To have had, never. Far better to have tasted love before dying than to die alone.
I suppose so. But I would have liked children and a settled home. I would like to have taken Drake to Drennan and shown him off a little. I would like some of those bitches at court to see that a man could love me.
She bit her lip, straining to hold back the tears. They are inconsequential. Whether they see you or not will not alter the fact that they were wrong. And it is a little early for despair. It is spring, and it will be many weeks before we reach the dross. All things can happen in that time. Ulrich may have a heart attack, or fall from his horse and crush his skull. Abelaine may make another treaty. The attack may come at another fortress. Who knows?
I know. You're right. I don't know why I'm suddenly so full of self-pity. Meeting Rec was marvellous for me. You should have seen him standing up to Reynard's outlaws. You know of Reynard?
Yes.
Well, you won't have to worry about him any more. He's dead. Anyway, Rec stood up to 20 of them because they were going to take me. 20? He would have fought them all. Damn, I'm going to cry.
Why should you not cry? You are in love with a man who adores you, and the future looks bleak and empty of hope. He walked to her, took her hand and pulled her to her feet.
Virai, it is always harder for the young.
She rested her head on his chest as the tears ran. He put his arms round her and patted her back.
Can Jos Delnok hold? She asked him.
All things can happen. Did you know Druss is on his way there?
He agreed. That is good news.
She sniffed and wiped her eyes on the sleeve of her shirt. Then Rex's words came back to her.
He's not senile, is he?
Vintar laughed aloud.
Druss? Senile? Certainly not. What a wonderful thought. That is one old man who will never be senile. It would mean giving in to something. I used to believe that if Druss wanted night to last longer, he would just reach up and drag the sun back down over the horizon.
You knew him?
Yes, and his wife Rowena. A beautiful child, a speaker of rare talent, gifted even beyond Serbitar.
I always thought Rowena was just part of the legend, said Virai. Did he really cross the world to find her?
Yes, said Vintar, releasing Virai and returning to his desk. She was taken prisoner soon after their wed, when the village was attacked by slavers. He hunted her for years. They were a blissfully happy couple.
Like you and Rick, I shouldn't wonder. What happened to her?
She died, soon after Skeln Pass. A weak heart.
Poor Drass, she said.
But he is still strong, you say? When he stares, valleys tremble, quoted Vintar. Where he walks, beasts are silent. When he speaks, mountains tumble. When he fights, armies crumble.
But can he still fight? She pressed.
I think he will manage a skirmish or two, said Vintar, roaring with laughter.
Chapter 7 2 days and 27 leagues from Skoda, and Drass, with a mile-eating soldier's stride, was nearing the lush valleys at the edge of Skultik Forest. He was 3 days' march from Drosdelnok, and evidence of the coming war met his eyes everywhere. Deserted homes, untended fields, and the people he did meet were wary and mistrustful of strangers. They wore defeat like a cloak, Drass thought. Topping a small rise, he found himself looking down on a village of maybe 30 homes, some crudely built, others showing signs of more careful construction. At the centre of the hamlet was a square, an inn, and a stable. Drass rubbed his thigh, trying to ease the rheumatic pain in his swollen right knee. His right shoulder ached, but this was a dull throbbing he could live with, a reminder of past battles when a Ventrian spear had cut under his shoulder blade. But the knee, this would not bear him many more leagues without rest and an ice pack. He hawked and spat, wiping a huge hand across his bearded lips. "You're an old man," he told himself. "There is no point in pretending otherwise." He limped down the hill towards the inn, wondering once more whether he should purchase a mount. His head told him yes, his heart said no. He was Drass the legend, and he never rode. Tireless, he could walk all night and fight all day. It would be good for morale when Drass walked into Drosdelnok. Men would say, "Great gods, the old boy's walked from Skoda." And others would answer, "Of course he has. That's Drass. He never rides." But his head told him to buy a horse and leave it at the forest edge, a mere 10 miles from the Dross. And who would be the wiser? The inn was crowded, but the innkeeper had rooms to spare. Most of the customers were passing through, heading south or west into neutral Vagria. Drass paid his money, took a canvas sack of ice to his room, and sat on the hard bed, pressing it to his swollen knee. He had not been in the main room for long, but long enough to hear some of the conversations and to recognize many of the men there as soldiers. Deserters. Always in war, he knew, there were men who would sooner ride than die. And many of the young men downstairs had seemed more demoralized than cowardly. Were things so bad at Delnok? He removed the ice and massaged the fluid away from the joint, his thick fingers pressing and probing, his teeth gritted hard against the pain. Satisfied at last, he opened his small pack and removed a length of sturdy cotton bandage, which he wound tightly about the knee, tucking the end into the fold. Then he rolled down his woolen leggings and pulled his black boot onto his foot, grunting as the injured knee tensed. He stood and walked to the window, pushing it open. His knee felt better. Not much, but enough. The sky was cloudless and blue, and a soothing breeze ruffled his beard. High overhead, an eagle circled. Drass returned to his pack, removing the crumpled letter from Delnar. He walked to the window for better light and smoothed the parchment open. The script was writ large, and Drass chuckled again. He was no reader,
and Delnar knew it.
"My dearest comrade, even as I write I receive messages about the Nadir army being gathered at Golgothia. It is plain that Ulrich is ready to expand south. I have written to Abilene, pleading for more men. There are none to be had. I have sent Virai to Vintar. You remember the Abbot of Swords? To request the 30. I clutch at straws, my friend. I do not know in what health this letter will find you, but it is written in desperation. I need a miracle, or the dross will fall. I know you swore never again to enter the gates, but old wounds heal, and my wife is dead. As is your friend Sieben. You and I are the only men living to know the truth of the matter, and I have never spoken of it. Your name alone will stop the desertions and restore morale. I am plagued on all sides by poor officers, politically appointed, but my heaviest load is Gan Orin, the commander. He is Abilene's nephew and a martinet. He is despised, and yet I cannot replace him. In truth, I no longer command. I have a cancer. It consumes me daily. It is unfair of me to tell you of it, for I know I am using my own impending death to ask of you a favor. Come and fight with us. We need you, Druss. Without you, we are lost, just as at Skeln. Come as soon as you can. Your comrade in arms, Earl Delnar. Druss folded the letter, pushing it into a deep pocket inside his leather jerkin. An old man with a swollen knee and arthritic back. If you pinned your hopes on a miracle, my friend, you will need to seek elsewhere. A silvered mirror stood next to a washbasin on an oak chest, and Druss stared hard at his reflection. His eyes were piercing blue, the beard square cut, the jaw beneath it firm. He pulled his leather helm from his head and scratched the thick mat of grey hair. His thoughts were somber as he replaced the helm and strode downstairs. At the long bar, he ordered ale and listened to the talk around him.
"They say Ulrich has 1,000,000 men, said one tall youngster. "And you heard what he did at Golgothia? When the city refused to surrender, and he had taken it, he had every second defender hanged and quartered. 6,000 men. They say the air was black with crows. Imagine, 6,000.
"Do you know why he did it?" Druss asked, breaking into the conversation. The men looked at one another, then back at Druss.
"Of course I know. He's a bloodthirsty savage, that's why."
"Not at all," said Druss. "Join me in a drink?" He called the innkeeper and ordered more ale. "He did it so that men like you could spread the word to other cities." "Wait, mistake me not," said Druss, as the man's anger flushed his face. "I do not criticize you for telling the story. It is natural for these tales to be passed on. But Ulrich is a canny soldier. Assume he took the city and treated the defenders heroically. Other cities would defend just as hard. But this way he sends fear ahead of him. And fear is a great ally."
"You talk like an admirer," said another man, shorter, with a curling blonde moustache.
"But I am," said Druss, smiling. "Ulrich is one of the greatest generals of the age. Who else in 1,000 years has united the Nadir? And with such simplicity. It is the Nadir way to fight anyone not of their tribe. With 1,000 tribes thinking this way, they could never become a nation. Ulrich took his own tribe, the Wolf's Head, and changed the style of Nadir war. To each tribe he conquered, he offered a choice. Join him or die. Many chose to die, but many more chose to live. And his army grew. Each tribe keeps its own customs, and they are honored. You cannot take such a man lightly."
"The man is a treacherous cur," offered a man from another group of speakers. "He signed a treaty with us. Now he is to break it."
"I'm not defending his morals," said Druss equably, "merely pointing out that he's a good general. His troops worship him."
"Well, I don't like the way you speak, old man," said the tallest of the listeners.
"No," said Druss. "Are you a soldier, then?" The man hesitated,
glanced at his companions, then shrugged. "Doesn't matter," he said. "Forget it."
"Are you a deserter, then?"
"I said forget it, old man," stormed the youngster.
"Are you all deserters?" asked Druss,
leaning back against the bar and scanning the 30 or so men gathered there.
"No, not at all," said one young man, emerging from the throng. He was tall and slim, dark hair braided beneath a helm of bronze. "But you cannot blame those who are."
"Don't bother with it, Pienaar," said one. "We have talked it over."
"I know, interminably," said Pienaar, "but it doesn't change the situation. The Ghan is a pig. Worse, he is incompetent. But in leaving, you are just making sure your comrades have no chance at all."
"They haven't any chance anyway," said the short one with the blonde moustache. "If they had any sense, they would leave with us."
"Dorian, you are being selfish," said Pienaar gently. "When the fighting starts, Ghan Orin will have to forget his idiot rules. We will all be too busy to worry about them."
"Well, I've had enough of it already," said Dorian. "Shining armour, dawn parades, forced marches, midnight inspections, penalties for sloppy salutes, uncombed crusts, talking after lights out. The man's mad."
"If you're caught, you will be hung," said Pienaar. "He doesn't dare to send anyone after us. They would desert too. I came to Dros Delnok to fight the Nadir. I left a farm, a wife and two daughters. I didn't come here for all that shining armour garbage."
"Then go, my friend," said Pienaar. "I hope you do not live to regret it."
"I do regret it already, but my mind is set," said Dorian. "I am heading south to join Woundweaver. Now there's a soldier."
"Is Earl Delnar still alive?" asked Druss.
The young warrior nodded absently.
"How many men still hold their positions?"
"What?" said Pienaar, realizing Druss was speaking to him.
"How many men have you at Delnok?"
"What concern is it of yours?"
"It's where I am heading."
"Why?"
"Because I have been asked, young laddie," said Druss, "and in more years than I care to remember, I have never turned down a request from a friend."
"This friend asked you to join us at Dros Delnok? Is he mad? We need soldiers, archers, pikemen, warriors. I haven't time to be respectful, old man, but you should go home. We have no need of greybeards."
Dross smiled grimly. "You're a blunt speaker, boy, but your brains are in your breeches. I have handled an axe for twice your lifetime. My enemies are all dead, or wished they were." His eyes blazed, and he stepped closer towards the younger man. "When your life has been spent in one war after another for 45 years, you have to be pretty handy to survive. Now you, laddie, your lips scarce dry from your mother's milk, are just a beardless boy to me. Your sword looks pretty there at your side, but if I chose I could kill you without breaking sweat."
A silence had fallen on the room, and the watchers noted the bright sheen on Pienaar's brow.
"Who invited you to Dros Delnok?" he said at last.
"Earl Delnar."
"I see. Well, the Earl has been ill, sir. Now, you may or may not be a mighty warrior still, and I most certainly am a beardless boy to you. But let me tell you this. Ghan Orin commands at Dros Delnok, and he will not allow you to stay, Earl Delnar or no. I am sure your heart is in the right place, and I am sorry if I sounded disrespectful. But you are too old for a war."
"The judgment of youth," said Druss. "It is seldom of value. All right, much as it goes against the grain, I can see I still have to prove myself. Set me a task, boy."
"I don't understand you," said Pienaar.
"Set me a task, something no man here can do, and we will see how the old man fares."
"I have no time for these games. I must return to the Druss."
He turned to go, but Druss's words hit him like a blow, chilling his blood.
"You don't understand, boy. If you do not set me that task, I will have to kill you, for I will not be shamed."
The young man turned again.
As you say. Very well. Shall we adjourn to the marketplace?
The inn emptied, the crowd forming a circle about the two men in the deserted village square. The sun beat down, and Druss sucked in a deep breath, glorying in the warmth of spring.
It will be pointless giving you a test of strength, said Pinar, for you are built like a bull. But war, as you know, is a test of stamina. Do you wrestle?
I have been known to, said Druss, doffing his jerkin.
Good. Then you may test your skill one at a time against three men of my choice. Do you agree?
All too simple against these soft, fat runners, said Druss.
An angry murmur arose from the crowd, but Pinar silenced them with a raised hand.
Dorian, Hagir, Somin, will you give old father here a trial?
The men were the first three Druss had met at the bar. Dorian removed his cloak and tied his shoulder-length hair behind his neck with a leather thong. Druss, unnoticed, tested his knee. It was not strong.
Are you ready?
Asked Pinar. Both men nodded, and immediately Dorian rushed the older man. Druss lashed out, grabbing the other's throat, then stooped to push his right hand between the man's legs and lifted. With a grunt and a heave, he hurled him 10 feet through the air to land like a sack on the hard-packed earth. Dorian half rose, then sat back, shaking his head. The crowd hooted with laughter.
"Who's next?" asked Druss.
Pinar nodded to another youngster. Then, observing the fear on the lad's face, he stepped forward.
"You have made your point, Greybeard. You are strong, and I am at fault. But Garn Orin will not allow you to fight."
"Laddie, he will not stop me. If he tries, I will tie him to a fast horse and send him back to his uncle."
All eyes turned as a hoarse cry split the air.
"You old bastard!"
Dorian had gathered up his longsword and was advancing towards Druss, who stood with arms folded, waiting.
"No," said Pinar. "Put up your blade, Dorian."
"Back off or draw your sword," Dorian told him. "I've had enough of these games. You think you are a warrior, old man? Then let us see you use that axe, because if you don't, I will put some air in your belly." "Boy," said Druss, his eyes cold, "think well about this venture, for make no mistake, you cannot stand before me and live. No man ever has."
The words were spoken softly, yet no one disbelieved the old man. Except Dorian.
"Well, we shall see. Draw your blade."
Druss slipped snugger from its sheath, his broad hand curling round its black haft. Dorian attacked and died. He lay on the ground, head half severed from his neck. Druss hammered snugger deep into the earth, cleansing the blade of blood, while Pinar stood in stunned silence. Dorian had not been a great swordsman, but he was certainly skilled. Yet the old man had batted aside the slashing sword and in one flowing motion had returned the attack, all without moving his feet. Pinar looked down at the body of his former companion. "You should have stayed at the Druss," he thought.
"I did not want that to happen," said Druss. "But I gave him fair warning. The choice was his."
"Yes," said Pinar. "My apologies for speaking the way I did. You will be a great help to us, I think. Excuse me, I must help them to remove the body. Will you join me for a drink?"
"I will see you in the long bar," said Druss.
The tall, dark-haired youngster, whom Druss had been scheduled to wrestle, approached him as he walked through the crowd.
"Excuse me, sir," he said. "I'm sorry about Dorian. He's hot-tempered. Always has been."
"Not any more," said Druss. "There will be no blood feud," said the man. "Good. A man with wife and daughters has no place losing his temper. The man was a fool. Are you a friend of the family?"
"Yes, sir. My name is Hagir. Our farms are close. We are... we're...
neighbours. Then, Hagir, when you get home, I hope you will see that his wife is cared for.
I'm not going home. I'm going back to the Dross.
What changed your mind?
With respect, you did, sir.
I think I know who you are. Make your own decisions, don't place them on my shoulders. I want good soldiers at Dross Delnok, but also I want men who will stand.
I didn't leave because I was frightened. I was just fed up with the crazy rules. But if men like you are prepared to be there, I will stick it out.
Good. Join me for a drink later. Now I am going to have a hot bath.
Dross pushed his way past the men in the doorway and went inside.
Are you really coming back, Hagir?
Asked one of the men.
Yes. Yes, I am.
But why? Urged another.
Nothing has changed, except that we shall all be on report and probably flogged. It's him. He's going there. The captain of the axe.
Dross. That was Dross.
Yes, I am sure of it.
How sickening, said the other.
What do you mean, Somin? Asked Hagir.
Dorian. Dross was Dorian's hero. Don't you remember him talking about him? Dross this and Dross that? It is one reason he joined up, to be like Dross, and maybe even to meet him.
Well, he met him, said Hagir somberly.
Dross, dark-haired Pinar, tall Hagir, and blunt-featured Somin sat at a corner table in the long room of the inn. Around them a crowd gathered, drawn by the legend of the grizzled old man.
Just over 9,000, you say. How many archers?
Dun Pinar waved a hand.
No more than 600, Dross. The rest are remnants of cavalry lancers, infantrymen, pikers, and engineers. The bulk of the complement is made up of volunteer farmers from the Centran Plain. They're plucky enough.
If I remember aright, said Dross, the first wall is 400 paces long and 20 wide. You will need 1,000 archers on it. And I don't just mean 1,000 bows. We need men who can pick a target from 100 paces.
We just haven't got them, said Pinar. On the credit side, we do have almost 1,000 legion riders.
Some good news, at least. Who leads them?
Gan Hogun.
The same Hogun who routed the Satuli at Cortswain?
Yes, said Pinar, pride in his voice. A skilled soldier, strong and disciplined, and yet worshipped by his men. He is not very popular with Gan Orin.
He wouldn't be, said Dross, but that's the matter we shall settle at Delnok. What of supplies?
There we have a few problems. There is enough food for a year, and we discovered 3 more wells, one as far back as the keep. We have close to 600,000 arrows, a multitude of javelins, and several hundred spare mail shirts. But the biggest problem is the town itself. It has spread from wall 3 down to wall 6, hundreds of buildings from wall to wall. There is no killing ground, Dross. Once over wall 6, the enemy has cover all the way to the keep.
We will tackle that too when I arrive. Are there still outlaws in Skultik?
Of course. When have there not been? Answered Pinar.
How many?
Impossible to say. 500 or 600, perhaps.
Do they have a known leader?
Again, hard to say, said Pinar. According to rumour, there is a young nobleman who heads the largest band. But you know how these rumours grow. Every outlaw leader is an ex-nobleman or a prince. What are you thinking?
I'm thinking they are archers, said Dross.
But you cannot enter Skultik now, Dross. Anything could happen. They could kill you.
True. All things could happen. My heart could give out, my liver fail, disease could strike me. A man cannot spend his life worrying about the unexpected. I need archers. In Skultik, there are archers. It's that simple, boy.
But it's not that simple. Send someone else. You are too valuable to lose like this, Pinar told him, gripping the old man's arm.
I'm too long in the tooth to change my ways now. Direct action pays off, Pinar. Believe me,
And there's more to it, which I will tell you about some other time. Now, he said, leaning back and addressing the crowd, you know who I am and where I am heading. I will speak plainly to you. Many of you are runners. Some are frightened, others are demoralized. Understand this. When Ulrich takes Dros Delnok, the Draenei lands will become Nadir lands. The farms you are running to will be Nadir farms. Your wives will become Nadir women. There are some things no man can run from. I know. At Dros Delnok, you risk death. But all men die. Even Dros, even Karnak the One-Eyed, even the Earl of Bronze. A man needs many things in his life to make it bearable. A good woman, sons and daughters, comradeship, warmth, food and shelter. But above all these things, he needs to be able to know that he is a man. And what is a man? He is someone who rises when life has knocked him down. He is someone who raises his fist to heaven when a storm has ruined his crop, and then plants again. And again. A man remains unbroken by the savage twists of fate. That man may never win, but when he sees himself reflected, he can be proud of what he sees. For lo, he may be in the scheme of things peasant, serf, or dispossessed, but he is unconquerable. And what is death? An end to trouble, an end to strife and fear. I have fought in many battles. I have seen many men die, and women too. In the main, they died proud. Bear this in mind as you decide your future. The old man's fierce blue eyes scanned the faces in the crowd, gauging reaction. He knew he had them. It was time to leave. He bade his farewells to Pina and the rest, settled his bill despite the protestations of the innkeeper, and set off for Skultik. He was angry as he walked, feeling the stares on his back as the inn emptied to watch him go. He was angry because he knew his speech had been a falsehood, and he was a man who liked the truth. Life, he knew, breaks many men. Some as strong as oak wither as their wives die or leave them, as their children suffer or starve. Other strong men break if they lose a limb, or worse, the use of their legs or their eyesight. Each man has a breaking point, no matter how strong his spirit. Somewhere deep inside him, there is a flaw that only the fickle cruelty of fate can find. A man's strength is ultimately born of his knowledge of his own weakness, Dros knew. His own fear was of dotage and senility. The thought of it set him to trembling. Did he really hear a voice at Skoda, or was it merely his own terror booming inside him? Dros the legend, mightiest man of his era, a killing machine, a warrior. And why? Because I never had the courage to be a farmer, Dros told himself. Then he laughed, dismissing all somber thoughts and self-doubt. It was a talent he had. Today had a good feel about it. He felt lucky. If he kept to known trails, he would certainly meet outlaws. One old man alone was a package not to be missed. They would be a sorely inefficient lot if he were to pass through the forest unnoticed and unattended. The woods were becoming thicker now as he reached the outskirts of Skultik. Huge gnarled oaks, graceful willows and slender elm interlinked their branches for as far as the eye could see, and greatly beyond, Dros knew. The noon sun made shafts of shimmering light through the branches, and the breeze carried the sounds of miniature waterfalls from hidden streams. It was a place of enchantment and beauty. To his left, a squirrel ceased its hunt for food and gazed warily at the old man as he marched past. A fox crouched in the undergrowth
and a snake slithered beneath a fallen trunk as he approached. Overhead, birds sang, a chorus full of the sounds of life. Throughout the long afternoon, Druss marched on, occasionally bursting into song, full-bodied and lusty versions of battle hymns from a score of nations. Towards dusk, he became aware that he was being watched. How he was aware, he could never explain. A tightening of the skin on his neck, a growing awareness that his back made a broad target. Whatever it was, he had learned to trust his senses in the matter. He loosened Snaga in her sheath. Some moments later, he entered a small clearing in a grove of beech trees, slender and wand-like against a background of oak. At the center of the clearing, on a fallen trunk, sat a young man, dressed in homespun garments of green tunic and brown leather leggings. Upon his legs lay a longsword, and by his side was a longbow and a quiver of goose-feathered arrows.
"Good day, old man," he said, as Druss appeared.
Lithe and strong, thought Druss, noting with a warrior's eye the cat-like grace of the man as he stood, sword in hand.
"Good day, laddie," said Druss, spotting a movement to his left in the undergrowth.
Another whisper of branch on cloth came from his right.
"And what brings you to our charming forest?"
asked the young man. Druss casually walked to a nearby beech and sat, leaning his back against the bark.
"A desire for solitude," he said.
"Ah, yes, solitude. And now you have company. Perhaps this is not a lucky time for you."
"One time is as lucky as another," said Druss, returning the other's smile. "Why don't you ask your friends to join us? It must be damp, skulking in the bushes."
"How rude of me, to be sure. Eldred, Ring, come forward and meet our guest."
Sheepishly, two other young men pushed their way through the greenery to stand beside the first. Both were dressed in identical clothing of green tunic and leather leggings.
"Now we are all here," said the first.
"All except the bearded one with the longbow," said Druss.
The young man laughed.
"Come out, Jorak. Old father here misses nothing, it seems."
The fourth man came into the open. He was large, a head taller than Druss and built like an ox, his massive hands dwarfing the longbow.
"Now, dear sir, we are all here. Be so kind as to divest yourself of all your valuables, for we are in a hurry. There's a stag roasting at camp, and sweet new potatoes garnished with mint. I don't want to be late."
He smiled, almost apologetically. Druss bunched his powerful legs beneath him, rising to his feet, his blue eyes glinting with battle joy.
"If you want my purse, you will have to earn it," he said.
"Oh, damn," said the young man, smiling and reseating himself. "I told you, Jorak, that this old fellow had a warrior look about him."
"And I told you that we should have merely shot him down and have taken his purse," said Jorak.
"Unsporting," said the first.
He turned to Druss.
"Listen, old man, it would be churlish of us to shoot you down from a distance, and that sets us a pretty problem. We must have your purse, don't you see? No point in being a robber else."
He paused, deep in thought, then spoke once more.
"You're obviously not a rich man, so whatever we get will not be worth a great deal of effort. How about spinning a coin? You win, you keep your money, we win, we take it. And I'll throw in a free meal. Roast stag. How does that sound?"
"How about if I win, I get your purses and a meal?" asked Druss.
"Now, now, old horse. No point in taking liberties when we're trying to be friendly. All right, how about this? Honour needs to be satisfied. How about a little skirmish with Jorak here? You look quite strong, and he's a dab hand at bare-knuckle squabbles."
"Done," said Druss. "What are the rules?"
"Rules? Whoever is left standing wins. Win or lose, we'll stand you a supper. I rather like you. You remind me of my grandfather."
Druss grinned broadly, reached into his pack, and pulled on his black gauntlets.
"You don't mind, do you, Jorak?" he asked. "It's the old skin on my knuckles. It tends to split. Let's get it over with."
said Jorak, advancing. Drus stepped in to meet him, taking in the awesome breadth of the man's shoulders. Jorak lunged, hurling a right cross. Drus ducked and crashed his own right fist into the other's belly. A whoosh of air exploded from the giant's mouth. Stepping back, Drus thundered a right hook to the jaw, and Jorak hit the ground face first. He twitched once, then lay still.
"The youth of today," said Drus sadly, "have no stamina."
The young leader chuckled.
"You win, Father Time. But look, for the sake of my fast diminishing prestige, give me the opportunity of beating you at something. We will have a wager. I wager my purse against yours that I am a better archer."
"Hardly a fair bet, laddie. I will concede that point. But I will make a wager with you. Strike the trunk of the tree behind me with one arrow, and I'll pay up."
"Come now, dear sir. Where is the art in that? Less than 15 paces, and the bowl is 3 hands wide."
"Try it and see," offered Drus.
The young outlaw shrugged, hefted his bow, and drew a long arrow from his doeskin quiver. With a fluid motion, his strong fingers drew back the string and released the shaft. As the outlaw's bow bent, Drus drew snagger, and the axe sang through the air in a glittering arc of white light as he sliced the blade to his right. The outlaw's shaft splintered as the axe struck. The young man blinked and swallowed.
"I would have paid to have seen that," he said.
"You did," said Drus. "Where is your purse?"
"Sadly," said the young man, pulling his pouch from his belt, "it is empty. But the purse is yours, as we agreed. Where did you learn that trick?"
"In Ventria, years ago."
"I've seen some axe work in the past, but that bordered on the incredible. My name is Bowman."
"I am Drus."
"I know that, old horse. Actions speak louder than words."
Chapter 8. Hogan swallowed back despair, his mind working furiously. He and 200 of his legion riders faced more than 1,000 Nadir dog soldiers, the cavalry wing of Ulrich's forces. Sent out to gauge the strength and disposition of the Nadir horde, Hogan was over 150 miles from Delnok. He had all but pleaded with Orin to forsake this plan, but the first gun was not to be dissuaded.
"A refusal to obey a direct order is punishable by instant dismissal for any of gun rank. Is that what you wish, Hogan?"
"You know that's not what I'm saying. What I'm telling you is that this mission is futile. We know from our spies and countless refugees the strength of Ulrich's forces. Sending 200 men into that wasteland is insane." Orin's brown eyes had blazed with anger, his fat chin trembling in a bid to suppress his fury.
"Insane, is it? I wonder, is it just that you don't like the plan, or is the famed Kortswain warrior afraid to meet the Nadir?"
"The Black Riders are the only seasoned troops of proven worth you have here, Orin," he said as persuasively as he could. "You could lose all 200 men with such a scheme, and learn from it no more than we already know. Ulrich has 500,000 men, and more than twice that in camp followers, cooks, engineers, and whores. He will be here within 6 weeks."
"Hearsay," muttered Orin. "You leave at first light."
Hogan had come close to killing him then, close enough for Orin to sense danger.
"I am your senior officer," he said, his voice close to a whine. "You will obey me."
And Hogan had. With 200 of his finest men, mounted on black horses, bred for generations as the finest war mounts on the continent, he had thundered his troop northwards as the dawn sun breasted the Delnok Mountains. Out of sight of the Dross, he had slowed the column and signalled the men to ride at ease, free to talk to their riding companions. Dun Elikas cantered alongside him, reining his horse to a walk.
"About business, sir?"
Hogan smiled, but did not answer. He liked young Elikas. The man was a warrior born, and a fine lieutenant. He sat a horse as if he had been born on one, a true centaur. And a hellion in battle, with his custom-made silver-steel sabre, 2 inches shorter than the standard version.
"What are we supposed to be finding out?"
he asked.
"The size and disposition of the Nadir army," answered Hogan.
"We know that already," said Elikas. What is the fat fool playing at?
Enough of that, Elikas, he said sternly. He wants to be sure the spies were not exaggerating.
He's jealous of you, Hogan. He wants you dead. Face it, man, no man can hear us. You know what he is, a courtier. And he has no guts. The dross won't last a day. He'll open the gates for sure.
He's a man under terrible pressure. The whole of the Drenai cause rests on his shoulders, said Hogan. Give him time.
We don't have time. Look, Hogan, send me to Woundweaver. Let me explain our situation. He could be replaced.
No. Believe me, Elikas, it would achieve nothing. He's Abelain's nephew.
That old man has a lot to answer for, snarled Elikas. If we do somehow get out of this business alive, he will fall for sure.
He has ruled for 30 years. It's too long. But as you say, if we do get out alive, it will be because of Woundweaver. And it's certain he will take control.
Then let me write to him now,
urged Elikas. The time isn't right. Woundweaver cannot act. Now leave it alone. We will do our job and, with luck, get away without being spotted. But luck had not been with them. 5 days out from Delnok, they had come across 3 Nadir outriders. They had killed only 2, the third ducking down over the neck of his steppe's pony and riding like the wind into a nearby wood. Hogan had ordered an immediate withdrawal and might have pulled it off had he enjoyed an ounce of luck. Elikas had been the first to spot the mirror messages flashing from peak to peak.
"What do you think, sir?" he asked as Hogan reined in.
"I think we will need good fortune. It depends how many dog soldiers they have in the vicinity." The answer was not long in coming. Towards late afternoon, they saw the dust cloud south of them. Hogan glanced over his back trail.
"Libus!" he called, and a young warrior cantered alongside. "You have eyes like a hawk. Look back there. What do you see?"
The young soldier shielded his eyes from the sun, then squinted at their back trail.
"Dust, sir, from maybe 2,000 horses.
And ahead? Perhaps 1,000. Thank you. Rejoin the troop. Elikas!
Sir!
Cloaks furled. We will take them with lances and sabres.
Yes, sir."
He cantered back down the column. The black cloaks were unpinned and folded to be strapped to saddles. The black and silver armour glinted in the sunlight as man after man began to prepare for the charge. From saddlebags, each rider removed a black and silver forearm guard and slipped it in place. Then small round bucklers were lifted from saddle horns to be fitted to the left arm. Straps were adjusted, armour tightened. The approaching Nadir could now be seen as individuals, but the sound of their battle cries was muffled by the pounding of horses' hooves.
"Helms down!" yelled Hogan. "Wedge formation!"
Hogan and Elikas formed the point of the wedge, the other riders slipping expertly into position, 100 on either side.
"Advance!" yelled Elikas.
The troop broke into a canter, then at full gallop, the lances tilted. As the distance narrowed, Hogan felt his blood racing and could hear his pounding heart in time with the rolling thunder of the black horse's iron-shod hooves. Now he could pick out individual Nadir faces and hear their screams. The wedge smashed into the Nadir ranks, the larger black war horses cleaving a path through the mass of smaller hill ponies. Hogan's lance speared a Nadir chest and snapped as the man catapulted from his pony. Then his sabre slashed into the air. He cut one man from his mount, parried a thrust from the left, and backhanded his blade across the throat of the horseman. Elikas screamed a Drenai war cry from his right, his horse rearing, the front hooves carving the chest of a piebald pony who ditched his rider beneath the milling mass of black riders. And then they were through, racing for the distant, fragile safety of Dros Delnok. Glancing back, Hogan saw the Nadir reform and canter to the north. There was no pursuit.
"How many men did we lose?" he asked Elikas as the troop slowed to a walk.
11.
It could have been worse. Who were they?" Elikas recounted the names. "All good men, survivors of many battles."
"That bastard Orin will pay for this," said Elikas bitterly.
"Forget it. He was right. More by luck than by any judgment, but he was right."
"What do you mean, right?
"'We've learned nothing, and we've lost 11 men,' said Elikas. "'We have learned that the Nadir are closer than we believed. "'Those dog soldiers were Wolf's Head tribe. "'That's Ulrich's own. They're his personal guard. "'He'd never sent them that far ahead of his main force. "'I'd say we now have a month, if we're lucky. "'Damn! I was going to gut the pig and take the consequences. "'Tell the men no fires tonight,' said Hogan. "'Well, fat man,' he thought, "'this is your first good decision. "'May it not be the last.'
Chapter 9 The forest had an ageless beauty that touched Druss's warrior soul. Enchantment hung in the air. Gnarled oaks became silent sentinels in the silver moonlight, majestic, immortal, unyielding. What cared they for man's wars? A gentle breeze whispered through the interwoven branches above the old man's head. A shaft of moonlight bathed a fallen log, granting it momentarily an ethereal splendor. A lone badger, caught in the light, shuffled into the undergrowth. A raucous song began among the men crowded around the blazing campfire, and Druss cursed softly. Once again the forest was merely forest, the oaks outsized plants. Bowman wandered across to him, carrying two leather goblets and a wine sack.
"'Finest Ventrian,' he said. "'It'll turn your hair black.'
"'I'm all for that,' said Druss.
The young man filled Druss's goblet, then his own.
"'You look melancholy, Druss. I thought the prospect of another glorious battle would lighten your heart.
Your men are the worst singers I have heard in 20 years. They're butchering that song, Druss replied, leaning his back against the oak, feeling the wine ease his tension.
Why are you going to Delnok? Asked Bowman.
The worst were a bunch of captured Satuli. They just kept chanting the same bloody verse over and over again. We let them go in the end. We thought that if they sang like that when they got home, they'd break the fighting spirit of their tribe in a week.
"'Now look here, old horse,' said Bowman. "'I am a man not easily thrown. Give me an answer, any answer. Lie if you like, but tell me why you travel to Delnok.
"'Why do you want to know?'
"'It fascinates me. A man with half an eye could see that Delnok will fall, and you're a man with enough experience to know the truth when you see it.' So why go?
Have you any idea, laddie, how many such lost causes I have been involved in during the past 40 or so years?
Precious few, said Bowman, or you would not be here to tell of them.
Not so. How do you decide a battle is lost? Numbers, strategic advantage, positioning? It's all worth a sparrow's fart. It comes down to men who are willing. The largest army will founder if its men are less willing to die than to win.
Rhetoric, snorted Bowman. Use it at the Druss. The fools there will lap it up.
One man against five, and the one disabled, said Druss, holding his temper. Where would your money go?
I'm ahead of you, old man. What if the one was Karnak the One-Eyed? Yes? Well, then my money would be on him. But how many Karnaks are there at Druss Delnok?
Who knows? Even Karnak was unknown once. He made his name on a bloody battlefield. There will be many heroes come the last at Druss Delnok.
Then you admit it. The Druss is doomed, said Bowman, grinning in triumph. At the last, you said.
Damn you, boy, don't put words in my mouth, snarled Druss, cursing himself. Where are you now, Sieben, he thought. Now that I need you with your glib words and ready wit.
Then don't try to treat me like a fool. Admit that the Druss is doomed.
As you say, admitted Druss, anyone with half an eye could see it. But I don't give a damn, laddie. Until the actual moment when they cut me down, I shall still be looking to win. And the gods of war are fickle at best. Where do you stand on the matter?
Bowman smiled and refilled both goblets. For a while he was silent, enjoying the wine and the old man's discomfort.
"'Well,' said Druss.
"'Now we come to it,' answered Bowman.
"'Come to what?' said Druss, ill at ease under the young archer's cynical gaze.
"The reason for this visit to my woods," said Bowman, spreading his hands, his smile now open and friendly. "Come now, Druss. I've too much respect for you to fence any longer. You want my men for your insane battle. And the answer is no. But enjoy the wine, anyway."
"Am I so transparent?" asked the old warrior.
When Druss the legend takes a stroll through Skultik on the eve of the end, he's looking for more than acorns.
"Is this all you want from life?" asked Druss. "You sleep in a wattle hut and eat when you can find game. When you cannot, you starve. In winter you're cold. In summer the ants crawl into your clothes and the lice prosper. You were not made for a life like this."
"We are not made for life at all, old horse. It is made for us. We live it, we leave it. I'll not throw my life away in your bloody madness. I leave such heroics to men like you. All your years have been spent in one squalid war after another. And what has changed? Have you thought that if you had not defeated the Ventrians 15 years ago at Skeln, we would not?